Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
LA police have now launched an internal investigation after a man says that he was unfairly attacked by a police canine, all because of his race. Fox 13's Lauren Steinbrecher shows us the video of the incident, and we do want to warn you, you might find some of this video disturbing.
Nearly 5 months since this intense moment. Jeffrey Ryans' left leg is still bandaged up, saying he's gone through surgeries and racked up medical bills.
I don't know why they had to use that type of force towards me because I was cooperating and I wasn't a threat to them.
According to Jeffrey and police body camera footage, this all unfolded in late April one night after someone called police upon hearing Jeffrey and his wife fighting.
Jeffrey!
After Salt Lake City police officers speak to Jeffrey's wife about a protective order, they see him behind the fence in the yard.
Keep your hands up. Get out of here.
Just going to work.
Come here. You're going to get bit. Get out here. Get bit.
One officer tells Jeffrey to stay put. Other officers and the canine run into the backyard, leading to this as Jeffrey gets down on his knees, his hands in the air.
Get on the ground. Get on the ground or you're going to get bit.
Get on the ground.
On the ground.
I'm on the ground. Why are you biting me?
Good boy.
Later, police and Jeffrey talk about what happened.
Should have listened, man. Told you to get down. He told you to get down on the ground.
That's why I dropped everything, because I didn't want to get shot. I definitely don't want to get bit.
Watching this video back, Jeffrey says he feels like a victim and that he was trying to comply.
But I wasn't doing anything wrong. I would have just put me in handcuffs, took me to jail. I would have dealt with my situation, and then that would be it. Instead of now, I got to deal with all this medical bills, it's just crazy.
His lawyers believe officers violated Jeffrey's civil rights and filed a notice of claim, which is the step before a lawsuit.
It's very difficult not to see how race could play a factor here.
He wasn't running, he wasn't doing anything that would have would have the officers have used this type of force. And so his biggest goal in this is to add to the conversation that we're having as a nation, that this can't happen again. We need to learn from this.
Salt Lake City Police said they can't talk about the specifics of the case because of pending litigation, but that they became aware of the situation Tuesday morning and have launched an internal affairs investigation to see if use of force was within policy. In Salt Lake City, Lauren Steinbrecher, Fox 13 News, Utah.
Salt Lake Police did release this statement this afternoon, saying in part, quote, the investigation will consider the totality of the events that occurred that night. As with every complaint regarding use of force, the Salt Lake City Civilian Review Board has the opportunity to conduct their own separate investigation.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast. Hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Thursday, August 13, 2020, so I have been told. We are back with the book club. We had a week off. I was not pleased about the week off. I was trying to finagle something here and there. We were in Washington, D.C. last week with the Cows Yoga Retreat, and I was thinking maybe I could, you know, pull some time and get away. Maybe the folks at the retreat are into the book club and all this, but it just was not feasible, especially since I'm doing the narration for this book club. But be that as it may, we are back, ready to roll. Romain Gary, White Dog. Our timing has been impeccable throughout the reading, and it continues. The report that you heard at the beginning from Utah, Mormon country, Mitt Romney. Days ago, literally, just days ago that was reported, another one of these canine hounds munching on a black person, maiming, terrorizing them once again. We will stay focused and keep rolling. Also, when we left off, it might take up folks a little back. When we left off, Romain Gary was describing the rioting that was happening in Washington, D.C. just after the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. He had a number of choice words to say about Stokely Carmichael that will continue. Kwame Ture, new name, but that will continue for this week with lots and lots of spiteful commentary on Stokely Carmichael, even some name calling. But without further ado, we are elated to get back to it. Romain Gary, White Dog, Context of White Supremacy, Audio Segment 1, Chapter 11. At every street corner, cops are chatting, looking bored, or laughing in their half tracks, watching absentmindedly or with amusement as store windows are smashed with bricks or iron bars. The most unusual audience this new kind of living theater ever had. What is immediately apparent when a race riot reaches its maximum intensity is the every man for himself aspect. Looters of all age, I saw a crippled, arthritic Methuselah helping himself to some psychedelic neckties, crash into each other, elbow each other out, ignore each other, or quarrel violently over goods in an I saw it first argument. Housewives look as if they were merely out shopping in the chaos of overturned shelves and merchandise. Businesslike ladies with families back home go about it reasonably, discriminatingly, not just grabbing whatever there is in a panic of greed, but carefully choosing the best and the most practical, what they really need, after thinking things over a good while. There are those who lose their heads and who aren't even aware of what they are grabbing, and those who seem to be shopping peacefully, looking at labels, prices, and trying things on. This is not a rebellion. This is response. The rage of looting is the natural response of countless consumers that are baiting society of provocation in sights in every possible way to buy without giving them the means to do so. I call society of provocation an affluent society given to constant exhibitionism of its wealth, summoning one and all to acquisitions, possessions, and materialistic enjoyment through high-pitched, never-easing-off advertising and tempting, teasing displays of goods and a continuous show of riches in the streets, while at the same time refusing all possibility of keeping up with this challenge in terms of satisfaction to a considerable segment of the population. Millions of underprivileged, frustrated people are both incited to possess and denied possession, teased and refused satisfaction, which means perfect psychological and social conditions for either neurosis or revolt or both. Advertising and the exhibition of wealth becomes a summons to progress or to a revolution, a call to social justice, or the overthrow of society. Who can pretend to be surprised when a kid from a black ghetto, surrounded by materialistic carnival of luxury stores, restaurants, supermarkets, supercars, a whole merchandising universe in which everything has been professionally designed to whet your appetite and make you go for it, actually does so with the only means available to him in the situation of neglect, frustration, and rejection, breaking through the economic barrier by smashing windows and looting? The entire civilization around him is totally bent on convincing him that he cannot do without this or that. The latest must from General Motors, Westinghouse, a grocery store, when the TV and radio and all the imaginable means of advertising and conditioning to buy bait him and goad him and, in fact, order him to go get it, get it, get it. And bear in mind that America as a whole, with its glut of prosperity, has the same effect on the masses of the underdeveloped, starving Third World as a Fifth Avenue luxury store on the psyche of a Harlem kid. This continuous provocation is an entirely new phenomenon in our civilization, if only because of the proportions it has taken. It's the equivalent of a call to rape. In the smoking streets through which we are driving, the big grab is on, and no one really cares what he grabs as long as it is possessions. Can you tell me what that long-necked boy with a purposeful, business-like expression on his intellectual-looking face plans to do with the naked store dummy he is carrying under his arm? Somebody has already ripped the clothes off it, and all the poor thing's got to offer is a kind of trophy of wax ass and wax tits. And what about that happily, proudly parading fellow with a cigar in his mouth and 9 or 10 waste paper baskets piled up in his arms? Possession. Period. Get it, man. Get it. I can understand far better the other fellow over there walking away with a load of toilet paper rolls. There's no telling what the future will be made of. Small kids, their faces smeared with jam, are breaking bottles of gefilte fish and gobbling up the fish on the spot, while a fat, bespeckled lady lifts a tiny pair of black lace panties to her bulging middle, and her neighbor meditates over a handful of drugstore costume jewelry with all the concentration of Hamlet looking at that no less trashy skull. And here is another thoughtful client who, after feeling a melon, shaking it, and listening to it, puts it aside and picks out another while the kids on the rampage smash another shop window. Who says they're looting? They are obeying. They are answering in the only way that can the come and get it call raised around them night and day through months and years by all the mass media. They are carrying out the orders of our merchandising hell. Looting is a triumph of subliminal persuasion. Red is driving the Chevy at a snail's pace. He nods towards some youths throwing melons against the window of an office supply store. Do you realize they don't even know half of the time what started this? He steps down hard on the brakes, stops the car. You don't believe me. Pas vrai, right? Let's ask him. He leans out and gestures to the kids. 15, 16? These are alley cats, shaved heads, watchful, suspicious eyes. Tell me, sonny, you know who Martin Luther King was? No, sir. And you? No, sir. A third boy comes by, his face still tight with excitement at the come and get it. He's just been killed. You know who he was? A moment of hesitation. Then it comes. Spontaneous, entirely devoid of any personal knowledge, thinking, or caring, the kid merely comes up with what he must have heard so often. He was an Uncle Tom. While I choke, Red shuts the door and steps on the gas. He was an Uncle Tom. Coretta King's face passes in front of me, perhaps the most beautiful woman's face that I have seen in my lifetime in its sorrow and quiet anguish. It evokes for me the essence of mythological femininity from Ruth to all the queens of Judea and Egypt, a face that an immortal picture taken during her husband's funeral revealed to the world. An expression of dignity in suffering that all our wretched Michelangelos and Bellinis and all our professional Pietas have striven in vain to create. I am overwhelmed by sheer blind fury. It is aimed at nothing and all things. It has no target or visible enemy. It is the hate of a dog looking for a throat. It is the hatred which gets hold of me whenever I am once again confronted with a manifestation of our greatest spiritual force, which is stupidity. Red, there was a lot of black fiendishness directed against King. You don't think that the murderer could be a nigger? Yes, could be. But niggers are all the white man's work. We're blacks. You've turned some of us into niggers. Hey, what is it? Only that's the first time you included me in them. Come on, that's just a way of talking. A group of teenagers come out of a drugstore they're looting, their arms full of boxes of Kotex and Tampax. I double up with laughter. Red shrugs. Nothing funny there. Sanitary napkins are great for making Molotov cocktails. They hold the gasoline better. We drive now through a quiet, empty street, turn left, and then Red stops the car. What follows may or may not be what I am tempted to call the truth about Stokely Carmichael. I am inclined to think I give him too much credit. I don't believe the man has got a black future. Let me make myself clear. Carmichael is the kind of enemy a white superiority establishment should cherish and strive to protect. His total rejection of, in his own terms, everything that is white, including the Marxist and therefore white doctrine orientation of the Black Panthers, is an extremely comfortable cop-out, the sort of ideological stand so totally devoid of any danger for white society or of any constructive hope for the blacks that it is difficult to imagine a safer, more hypocritically calculating position for a black militant in America. It is a deluxe ivory tower attitude that has the great advantage of looking like an avant-garde fighting position. It is white smoke in black people's eyes. During the last 2 years, after a pioneering period in the thick of the battle, is it because things became too hot and dangerous for a man having made such a loving investment in himself? He suddenly rose above the melee, the blood and the jails, to the perfectly harmless and safe heights of the all that is white is unacceptable position. Getting fat somewhere out there in Africa at the patrician Nkrumah's court, the same Nkrumah whose chief doctor and personal physician was the infamous assistant to Dr. Mendel in the Nazi medical extermination camps, and whose pilot was the favorite lady pilot of Hitler. Carmichael's facile and no doubt fruitful anti-Semitism is a pathetic You show me yours, I'll show you mine, kindergarten stuff. Admittedly, there are some tragic Jews and Negroes who feel they will never achieve true psychological equality unless they can be Nazis too. I'm so free, folks, so equal, that behold, I too can be a Nazi. Everything that is white should be destroyed is an ideological platform that is gaming niggers, and as far as purpose, help, hard work, fighting, or you name it, is concerned, amounts to a sybaritical collaboration with white elite society. It smacks of scorn for the black intelligence and common sense and sinks to conning. When you read Eldridge Cleaver's letters and writings from exile, there is one thing, at least one, that you know. Here is a man saying to America, "This is also my land. I built it with my black hands, and I want it back." It is infinitely more difficult, courageous, exigent, and danger-wrought position than playing court jester to Nkrumah. I saw Carmichael with my own eyes standing in front of a department store with a group of some 50 to 70 youngsters. He was screaming. I have no right to put together the words I was able to catch only now and then, and I have to fall back on the reports of a black journalist present for such words as were published in the press. The scenario may be summarized as follows. Appearance of Carmichael in the street among the young rioters. He goes into a department store and orders the staff to leave and close shop. He walks back into the street and, here again I am quoting the black reporter, he starts waving a small caliber gun, shouting, "What are you doing here empty-handed? Go back home and get your pieces." At that moment, one of the kids pulls a gun from his pocket and shows it. A police car is 50 yards away. Stokely's reaction, according to the press, "No, I don't want to see one drop of black blood lost here." I have no way of knowing, unfortunately, for it would be to Carmichael's great credit if this account is correct. But if the press can be trusted, the episode is of capital importance to all those who wish to understand the extraordinary verbal violence of the black militants and its remarkable achievements. I have heard them yell at me time and time again in my own apartment in Paris that America is in for rape, murder, and an all-out kill and get killed. The psychological result of this is evident to all those who take the trouble to meet young black people. That result is a total break with the past. White inbred feelings of inferiority and of "you are a nigger" guilt. The Jewish people have been through it. If you repeat over centuries to a human being, "You are subhuman," it is hard for the person concerned not to be persuaded, not to feel subhuman, and to even behave as a subhuman creature. Innumerable Jews have been, throughout the ages, thus persuaded by Christian and anti-Semites to the point that many gave in to self-hatred and some began to conform to the anti-Semitic persuasive caricature of the lowly Jew. They became Shylocks and Fagins. Their sense of dignity had been destroyed and they became distorted and lowly. This has also been the black man's lot. But it is over, very much over, and this is the achievement of the murderous, all-defying appeals to violence of people like Rap Brown, the early Stokely Carmichael, and above all, the Black Panthers. the verbal violence so infuriating to whites not merely reduced the need for physical violence, how many whites have black radicals actually killed over the years, including the police, in politically motivated aggressions? But it succeeded in giving the young blacks a feeling of total psychological equality with the whites. This is the black revolution that has actually taken place. The rest may be even more difficult to achieve, but at least the civil rights battle won't be fought by losers. Far from provoking massacres, where are they? The incendiary verbal violence of the ghetto leaders removes the need for physical violence. What is called ghetto rhetoric stems from the psychological need to dare. It is not simply letting off steam. It is taking your testicles out of hock. Carmichael's attitude in the street was typical of this reconquest of your soul. He hurries into that store, gets the whites out, orders the doors closed. Back among the youthful crowd, he sends them home to get your weapons, pieces. While 9 times out of 10, none of them have any, which amounts to clearing the street. When one of the youngsters shows suddenly a mean-looking pistol, Carmichael yells, "No, not a drop of black blood is going to be lost here," which, while unquestionably saving the kid's life, saves white lives as well. And yet, the purpose has been achieved and a major psychological battle won. There are very few young niggers left in America today, and fewer young Toms. And there is also that unbelievable verbal inflation of our time, the swelling of words beyond all reality of meaning, which seems to portend some total exhaustion of vocabulary to be followed, hopefully by some at least approximate authenticity that has almost completely gone out of the relationship between word and truth. The extravagant claims of both commercial advertising and political propaganda have broken any link of authenticity between the product pushed by the big sell, deodorant, or ideology of precedent and its true nature, the toothpaste, the ideology, or the leader that will save teeth or humanity run neck to neck in the race away from truth and reality, and even Pope Paul VI himself, alas, doesn't lag far behind. Did he not announce the other day that the revolt of the Dutch clergy against the rule of celibacy is a crucifixion of the church? Who can top that? Or must one really remind the Pope what the crucifixion was? It is in the context of this mountainous swelling of words which have become tinsel wrappings over any kind of merchandise put on the commercial or political market in this perspective of constant escalation in search of superlatives, with the price of words in terms of true meaning getting cheaper and cheaper, that the so-called incitations to murder or violence of the black extremists should be viewed, for, after all, there has been, so far, no irreparable passage from word to deed. Let's say that there is about as much deed in the Black Panthers' bloody words as there is actual deed in our words like democracy, freedom, dignity, brotherhood, peace, you name it, we've got it. Red lets me off at the Hilton. I get out and am about to tell him, "Mon vieux, be careful." But the comical enormity of this kind of advice to a man in his position reminds me of the advice my mother gave me during the war. I was returning from leave, heading back into the thick of the anti-aircraft shells, low-level bombing, and German fighter attacks, and my mother told me, "Don't forget to put your scarf on when you go flying. You've always had a delicate throat." Red, what is the truth? Even if you get 25,000 black Vietnam pros in your ranks, there'll still be 100,000 Vietnam pros facing them. The face is all closed up. I had never seen him sad before. All the black sadness went into the blues or was swallowed long ago. Have you met any sad black kids recently? Whatever you may have read in their expression, it wasn't sadness, I bet. Sadness, that was niggers. Well, if we fail, there's a moment of hesitation. As he stares at me, I believe that for one brief second, he is seeing me as a white man. But it's a 20-year-old friendship, and there is no black and white in that. I don't think it matters much if we fail now. We've achieved something like a total victory. There are no more niggers amongst our youngsters. Okay, so we fail. The ones they call the extremists, the radicals. So what? It means that we've done for the moderates everything they would never have been able to do without us. Sans nous. Without us. They wouldn't have a chance.
Grâce à nous, ils vont pouvoir jouer. Thanks to us, they may be able to make it. In the case of the Black Revolution, extremists do the dirty work for the moderates. Salute. Salute. The Chevy drives away. Chapter 12. Back in my suite, and 10 minutes later, I find myself pulling hard on my leash, trying to hold back an itching right foot as it pleads to kick in the ass one of those big Hollywood stars all wrapped up in their egos, princes of nothing, enthroned in that alcohol-swollen, stinking kingdom of I. There they dwell in the constant fear that for a few seconds the world may be caught thinking of something else besides them. He is to play the male lead in a picture with Jean, which I have written and am supposed to direct, and he has flown in from Hollywood for discussions about his and Jean's parts and the relationship between the two characters. For the last 2 days, he has been hanging around talking psychological background while the riot-torn city echoes with fear, rage, and anguish around us. One of those incredible sub-products of the actor's studio technique, which plays psychological reality with its students, mixing psychodrama and group analysis in an attempt to hit upon that inner truth and authenticity which amount to a painstakingly nurtured neurosis, a search for reality and identity, the results of which can be observed in a generation of actors who have broken with both and whose never-ending "what the hell am I all about" results in a total preoccupation with themselves. Ever since his arrival here, the guy has been rapping about a love scene in the script that he hadn't cracked yet, and that he wanted to rehearse with Jean to live it. here he was once more waiting for me in my suite, soaking in bourbon. On the TV screen, the open coffin, the face of Martin Luther King, and the slow march of people filing past it, black faces of all ages, with, often, that total blankness, that lack of expression, which is to a human face what silence is to the lack of adequate words. But the whiskey-guzzling King of I has other fish to fry. His eyes had that oily paleness, both transfixed and translucent, in their coagulated blue of the confirmed alcoholic. He prattles on and on. All he wants is to rehearse the love scene with my wife in his bedroom. That's why he flew here. He is bitter, shocked in his depths of artistic integrity because Gene Seberg refuses to come to his bedroom and perform. She'll do it, she says, but only if the director is present. Now, he doesn't want any goddamn director bothering him. There's got to be a real feeling of intimacy there. A truly genuine approach. See? It's essential that the two actors get to know each other. I mean, get real close. Find out how they really react to each other. Small things, you know. How each of them goes about it. The gestures. The movements. We've got to feel each other. To live the situation. So that later, when filming, there's a point of reference. A bond of experience. Something to fall back on. Couldn't I, as a creative person myself, convince Gene to go down to his suite for a bit of rehearsing? In short, this little son of a bitch, whore, is asking me to persuade my wife to get laid by him. On the TV screen, the dead face of Martin Luther King. The King of I doesn't give a damn. Not one glance. Glass in hand, and glassy-eyed, he raps on, working himself up to a kind of verbal climax. You can feel the fear of the sex act and the need for verbal self-reassurance. My hands are almost pulling away from me, little animals tugging on their leash. They're after that bottle. Grab it. Hit the idiot over the head. Come on. The whole business would have been farcical but for the dead face of the apostle of nonviolence on the TV screen. Nonviolence. Nonviolence. Dr. King, did you really know what brute animal force within us you were trying to exercise? We can't reach any kind of authenticity, of artistic integrity, unless we have a point of reference in reality. Gene doesn't seem to get that. I'm a bit disappointed in her as an actress. Jesus Christ, Holy Moses, and all the saints, help me. I rivet my eyes on the biblical face of Coretta King. Nonviolence, help me, please. I make a compromise. A kick in the ass isn't really violence. It's good-natured, sort of. And it's refreshing to have an ice bucket emptied on your face while you're trying to pick yourself up from the floor. I even help him back on his feet. My movie fell through right there and then. It was never to be made. The most expensive kick in the ass in the history of butt. Since the movie was budgeted for $3 million. I switched off the TV. I feel that those dead eyes saw me do it. How do you get rid of the world? Good God. Peace. All I want is a little peace and quiet. It was that night, as I was undressing, that Red's mysterious little phrase flashed through my mind. Gene, what's that about pouring gasoline over a dog and setting it on fire? You spoke to Red about it? When Jean looks guilty, you think she was 8 years old. I didn't tell you about it because you would have thrown one of your fits. Well, what is it? Most of our friends knew about our problem dog, and so did some of our neighbors on Arden. I was somewhere between India and Thailand when a group of young white radicals knocked at Jean's door. There were four or five of them, and the most articulate member of the group was the son of a wealthy businessman whose magnificent estate on Cresswell Drive reigns in tropical splendor among its exotica of plants, trees, rock, gardens, pools, high above the green, lovely lanes of Cherokee and Beaumont. This is one of those corners of the world where beauty dwells, and I would often drive up into the hills and sit there in my car, soothing my inner turmoils with all that loveliness. Jean had asked the youngsters in. The cautious, if not downright hostile, French way of talking to strangers through a barely open door goes down badly with Americans. They are very hospitable people, which explains all the murders. Miss Seberg, we're from the SDS, Students for a Democratic Society. I'm sure you know. We know you try to help the movement. Right now, we're building a common front with all those who are against the war in Vietnam for a nationwide protest. Jean told me the boy was a strikingly handsome fellow, and this may sound irrelevant, but it isn't as far as Seberg is concerned. She suffers from a bad case of sympathy at first sight, and has in her that streak of romanticism which tends to confuse physical beauty with that of inner treasures of the human soul. I say this without a trace of irony for her idealism, but with a deep resentment for all those who are not like her. Idealism, liberalism, and the general mixing up of humanitarian emotions with ideas is considered today as a do-goodnik's opiate by all honest-to-God, shit-eating realists. I happen to believe firmly that man, in terms of culture, liberty, and dignity, is incompatible with realism, and that it is almost totally irrelevant to argue if such a man exists. It is enough to build a civilization around this non-existence. If God has failed, it is not because he does not exist. It is because humanity has never been able to behave as if God did exist. A good Christian is not a man whose purpose in life is to prove the existence of God. We're trying to reach people, Miss Seberg. Their sensitivity, I mean. Hit that nerve, you know? If you could spare us a few minutes, as an action, you'll immediately understand how dramatic and effective our demonstration can be. Sit down. They did. No doubt Sandy went round shaking hands. Would you like a drink? The bastards. Botka was back at Noah's Ark. Anyway, those white kids would have run no risks. They smelled real good. I believe you have a vicious dog and you want to get rid of it. The guy was stroking Sandy. Sandy offered him his paw. That dog loves everybody, which I consider a lack of loyalty. I don't see what my dog has to do with Vietnam, Jean said. You see, for years, We've been burning the people over there with napalm. Whole villages. People read this in the paper over breakfast, watch it on TV, and don't give a damn. It just doesn't get through to them. It's become part of the daily routine. In fact, they look at it and it's become so familiar they can't see it, really, any longer. It's a thing that has lost its reality. Now, all these people who no longer react to burning people with napalm would raise a terrible howl if the same thing was done to a dog. That would be cruelty. Man, real cruelty. They'll suddenly get an idea of what's going on in Vietnam. So we're going to get a few dogs, douse them with gasoline, set them alight, and send them running in front of TV cameras so that this whole nation will see it. We know you're for peace, Miss Seberg, so we thought you might like to participate by giving us your dog. The year was 1968, if you count only Jesus Christ. Get the hell out of here, Seberg told them. That's an instinctive, irrational reaction, Miss Seberg. Why don't you give it some thought? These tactics call for a correct critical analysis, and you can't deny that if the war in Vietnam is shortened, if only by a day, the sacrifice of a few dogs. I never said I was a Marxist-Leninist, she told them. We know that. We are merely appealing to your humanitarian feelings. Jean was up in arms, and I wish I had been there, though I must say her sweet face is not made for hate. Your little stunt is the same kind of thing that leads to lies in the name of truth. Stalin, the hanging of Slansky in Prague in the higher interest of the party. You've come to the wrong person. I'm just not political enough for shit. They got up. One of them even came up with an admirable statement. Vietnam is not even a matter of politics any longer. It's a matter of human decency. You may think the whole incident was nothing but a student's prank or even a woolly-headed liberal's provocation by some staunchly patriotic kids on a film star who dares to take herself seriously. I must dispel your illusions on that score. This was a true, die-hard, sincere, anti-war, anti-man's inhumanity manifestation. It has since been carried out elsewhere, and only recently in Berlin, and the papers reported these facts in November 1969. I was away, and these young left-of-the-left Nazis were able to leave the house without a memorable handshake. We flew back to L.A. the next day, and after leaving Jean at Arden, I drove directly to the kennel. Chapter 13. I confess that the white dog was assuming symbolic proportions in my mind, and you may well shrug them off and show the usual patronizing impatience of a diehard, feet-on-the-ground realist for those whom you see as more inclined toward poetic justice than to the everyday humble struggles and truth. I am not apologizing for myself, as I am certainly more impatient with myself than those who, after all, don't have to live with me the way I have to. I am sorry to be the kind of Democrat who believes that the aim of democracy is to make not only man, but also man, to make all men aristocrats. I cannot see democracy as anything other than an ultimate nobility. And, of course, America is the only nation in history to have started out as a democracy. What happens here is the world. Besides, my nerves, which are supposed to be of steel, had begun to give way. I have never had a crack up here, but this is a country famous for its know-how. There were nights when I would wake up in nameless terror, a terror that was animal in its refusal to obey rational, lucid thinking. Why should I deny that I was identifying myself with that dog in his cage, unable to formulate the question that was torturing him, and without a master capable of answering the why? That is the only question worth asking on this earth. There were moments in Washington when I felt certain that they, either Jack or Keyes, had put White Dog to sleep out of sheer mercy because he has been ruined forever and nothing but death could be a solution. I remember the nice young German whom I had heard talking in a train compartment on my way back from Sweden in 1937. Now, sure, this is not the Jews' fault. You can't really blame them. They've been made the way they are by other people. They've been spit upon and told they were dreck for 1,000 years, and they've become just that, dreck, through sheer persuasion. Ja, they've been persuaded, convinced, or whatever you may call it. But the point is, they fit the image. They're too far gone, and you can't undo that. You can't change them. I really think all you can do is to kill them off painlessly out of sheer mercy. I had attacked the guy with a beer bottle and spent 5 days in jail in Dusseldorf. I had kept calling Carruthers on the phone from wherever I happened to be during those months, and he kept answering patiently, "Get off my back. Keyes is the one who handles the dog now. He's in charge." Keyes. I had never met a man who had that kind of symmetry with me. That is the best way I can put it. It is Sunday, and there is no one at the ranch. The caretaker, Fred Tatum, is an old trapeze artist from Ringling Brothers times. He must be over 70. Yes, Keyes is taking good care of the dog. The old man falls silent, chews his tobacco, and looks as if he wants to say more, but thinks better of it, mumbles some appropriate remarks about the smog that bitches up the spring, and hands me the key. Botka's warm welcome is up to my expectations, an affectionate nudging, smelling, licking with his paws on my shoulder. I notice that he looks in great shape, well-fed, contented, his coat shining, with good health. Then he runs to his leash and looks at me meaningfully, a few barks inviting me for a nice walk. I take him for a run in Griffith Park, and he frisks about happily for an hour, reveling in the good outdoor smells. On the way back, I stop at Hughes Market for some groceries, leaving the dog in the car. I must have spent a quarter of an hour shopping. When I come back to the parking lot, I see that Botka has escaped from the car after pushing the window down, probably with his muzzle. I had left it a bit open to give the dog some air. There is a baby carriage parked against the wall, no doubt by one of those young mothers in bright pants wandering around the market, and Botka is up on his hind legs, his front paws against the carriage, peering inside with keen interest. I smile and start walking toward the carriage, and then... I don't think I have ever felt so scared in my life, and yet, God knows, I am paralyzed with fear, holding my shopping bags under my arms, my whole body turned into ice. It's a black baby. Batka's nose is barely a few inches from the little face and comes closer. And then, White Dog glances at me, bright-eyed, as if amused, as if inviting me to share in a good joke. Then he turns his mug back toward the baby, wags his tail, and proceeds to lick the little black face. My relief and gratitude are such that I feel my face going to pieces. I walk to the dog and take him gently by the collar. His ears are pricked up, and he has that bright, expectant look of a dog who has found a playmate. The baby kicks his feet and laughs. Batka sniffs him and tries to lick his face again. I drag him away to the car, get inside, shut the door, and sit there for a long while, drained of all strength. I snap out of it and drive slowly toward the valley. I keep a loving hand on the dog's head for company. I give a full account of the miracle to Tatum, but the old boy doesn't seem too happy. A kind of mute disapproval. He keeps looking oddly at Batka. Animals, he says vaguely. Yeah, I know animals. Known 'em all my life. You can make 'em do anything. Cold bastard. I waited impatiently for Jean to come home to give her the exciting news. White Dog was on the way to complete recovery. Now, admittedly, it wasn't a real full-size black. It was only a baby. But you have to begin somewhere. She didn't appear over-enthusiastic. She listened with a tired air, took off her shoes, and said with a trace of irritation, "Big deal. At this rate, it's going to take 75 years. Who wants to wait?" To my surprise, Noah, Jack Carruthers, came up with almost the same reaction the next morning. "Yeah, well, if we're to begin at the cradle, there'll be lots of fun." Jackie Boy had greeted me with one of his sour, "here comes my toothache again" expressions. I seemed to have a nauseating effect on him, like drinking a glass of vinegar slowly. True, he was in good company. There was a whole population of baby chihuahuas at the infirmary. He was feeding them with a dropper. At the back of the room, the vet and Terry were attending Miss Bo, the distinguished lady chimpanzee, whom you may have seen on TV in an ad urging you to brush your teeth with the newest 100% better toothpaste, with enzymes, of course. Miss Bo had swallowed a whole tube of the stuff, including the tube, and was in the middle of a stomach-pumping session.
Context of white supremacy. Gusty Renegade. Woo! First audio segment. So for me, we're stopping on 139, kind of the top of 139. We'll pick up where Carruthers is saying, "I'll tell you one thing, Gary." That's what we're starting at on pretty much the top of 139. I have been saying, hashtagging, ready for revolution, for a couple of weeks now. I'm not a fan of the term revolution. In fact, I would encourage caution before using that term. That's a word that gets used frequently, often without a good definition. So at minimum, caution, and it's not a term that I use, but be that as it may, Ready for Revolution, I have been using it in association with the book club reading of White Dog specifically because that is the title of Stokely Carmichael's autobiography, Ready for Revolution. That's why I have been using that hashtag since we've had this onslaught that no count Stokely Carmichaeling. Just putting that into perspective because that has been baffling for, I won't say baffling, but that has been one of the more profound points of this book, in a book that is rife with symbolism and profound moments. We're in the, I mean, if you can even fathom, and it's difficult to do so just because, but the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. So this event just happened. You're watching the funeral. As opposed to serious reflection on Dr. King's life, what he meant, the assassination, all of that. Now, I want to take this time to talk about that no-count, shiftless Negro, Stokely Carmichael. I mean, what? And I mean on and on. Like, we get to Dr. King. Yes, he was killed. That's tragic. But I mean, I just got to take a few moments to talk about this no-count, gaming whitey, Stokely Carmichael. We just got to take a few. We get to Dr. King. You know, settle down. We'll get to him. Back to Stokely Carmichael. What? Romaine Gary. And then have the same thing happen again, to be reading this book and have that happen again for Bill Clinton to come out. Yes, that John Lewis was great, fantastic congressman. Led SNCC, and then he departed, and we were left with the likes of Stokely Carmichael. Ugh, who wants that? Whoa, we have a funeral, and we gotta talk bad about Ready for Revolution. Made me think we need to read his book, but Ready for Revolution is long, like, wow. Maybe it would take a whole year. It's really long, but it is very, very good. Very, very good. Right, Michael Falwell was a guest on The Cows in 2013. He edited the book, really co-authored. He has a lot of footnotes within the book. He helped Kwame Ture put it together towards the end of his physical existence. But that was back in 2013 in the archives. But, yeah, Ready made me think. Maybe Stokely Carmichael, we should read a little bit more, quote him a little bit more, if he's going to rankle whites this much. Ready for Revolution. So the number to dial is 720-716-7300, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 720-716-7300, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. You can drop an email as well, untiljustice@gmail.com, untiljustice@gmail.com. That way, if you have folks who are not able to call, or if you just want to write in, we can include you as well. Let's see. So sad we had to miss last week. Super bummed. But thankfully, we are back and ready to roll. Hopefully, folks did not lose interest or forget where we left off at in the reading. But we talked about White Dog at the retreat. We watched the actual movie White Dog at the retreat. It was definitely thought about the entire time last week, and we saw a number of white canines in color and conduct while we were strolling the water in D.C. But anywho, let's see. Folks who dialed in, if you have comments, questions, observations, let's see. Boop, boop, boop. Line should be open. Proceed. Folks are getting their thoughts together. Actually, we'll get through some of our emails from what we missed out. Let's see. One of our investors wrote in. We'll get his email, and then we'll get to some of the folks who dialed in as well. I'll share some of my notes also. So first person wrote in, writes, number one, recent white dog attack. Let's see. Moments, cops order police dog for attack a black St. Louis man. And this is in the Daily Mail. And this just happened this week. Today, let's see, is the 13th. Yeah, August 13th. And so this happened on the 12th, yesterday, I think. Anywho, and the report that we started with out of Utah, that was from, I believe, like 3 days ago, so like Monday of this week. Anywho, so he continues. Get back to the text, actually. Chapter 12. The author continues his references to dogs confirming his identification with white dog that Gus and other readers have mentioned. I find myself pulling hard on my leash, end quote. My hands are almost pulling away from me, the little animals tugging on their leash, direct quote. Number two, the Students for Democratic Society, SDS, proposed burning dogs with gasoline to protest the Vietnam War to Jean, which she rejected. I could not find any references to this after a web search trying to confirm its actual occurrence in Berlin, 1969. Let's see. Chapter 13. The author confirms explicitly his identification with white dog. Why should I deny that I was identifying myself with white dog in this cage, with that dog in his cage, excuse me. Number two, the author overheard on a train in Sweden Germans talking about Jews in 1937. Now, sure, this is not the Jews' fault. They're too far gone. All you can do is kill them off painlessly out of sheer mercy, end quote. The racist in this situation may be subliminally commenting on themselves. Ponder on that one. Number three, the author. I waited impatiently for Jean. White dog was on the way to complete recovery. Now, admittedly, it wasn't a full-size black, and he has that in bold-faced print. I have been paying closer attention to the author's use of the word black, which has been mentioned by Gus and other readers as being pejorative. The way it is used, one could seemingly substitute the word nigger. I would have thought differently about it if the author had said an adult black male, but he doesn't do that. He says in the book it's repeatedly the blacks, the blacks, the blacks, a black. That's what he says. He doesn't, yeah. Number four, let's see. Carruthers states Keyes was an honest-to-God, white-hating black Muslim. Didn't get that far. We'll have to pick up there a little bit later. Okay, so we'll stop right there. And we'll pick up the rest of this commentary as we get a little further along in the text. Number again, 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate.
Can I be heard?
Thomas in New York? Yes, sir.
Good evening, Gus. I was reading an article a couple days ago. It was in, the Princeton Review, but it says, stop calling racist rhetoric a dog whistle. So I said, ooh. And, but it was about the term dog whistle. But it's about racism. But, you know, I thought it was about white dogs. Man, I personally like the author's assessment of Stokely Carmichael, Fame Torre. I think it was accurate. Uses psychological techniques on blacks to incite emotion and not action. Rhetorical tough talking and black feel-goodism is what I call it. And he was an expert at that. The white supremacist knocking on the door to borrow their white dog. I could just see that now. Oh man, they got a dog that hates niggas. Let's go get their dog. They're gonna, you know, and think that, you know, someone's gonna let you borrow their dog. You know, like, that's kind of like someone you don't know asking to borrow your car. I could see white people doing that. You know, she should be down for the cause. And did he say that the dog was affectionate to a black baby? Was I mishearing that?
He explains that he took the dog out for a walk, run, what have you, out of the kennel, and he left him in the car briefly to go get some groceries. The dog escapes, and he's nuzzling a baby in a carriage. Then he gets closer and finds out that it's a black baby.
And then he licked the baby's face, right?
Right.
Right. So I wonder if metaphorically, because I've seen, you know, devout white supremacists love a little black baby. Oh, he's so cute. Pick him up, give him a kiss, you know. The baby is not a threat. You know, I guess once you turn around Tamir Rice's age, you start to look 30. But for some reason, you can even see that in old movies, like where they show, you know, these downtrodden Negroes with the uppity white people, and, you know, they have a baby, and, oh, look at the little Negro baby, you know, and, you know, color purple, you know, oh, look how clean your kids are. I've seen that a lot. I wonder if that, because I'm still not 100% sure that this is all accurate. I wonder if he was trying to allude to the fact maybe the dog, like white people, don't have a problem with black babies. And I mute my line. Thank
you. Much obliged, Thomas in New York. There will be more discussion of the black babies and vodka. That is a sound clip. Black babies cost less. But yeah, that'll be brought up in more detail in the text. The number again, 720-716-7300, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Let's see. Other folks dialed in, if you have commentary to share, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, retired firefighter.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings to everyone. I'm not surprised about the comments on Kwame Ture at that time, Stokely Carmichael. Mr. Carmichael through his political career that I'm aware of spoke directly to the subject of racism, white supremacy, and especially with about white people. And although he did had some close relationship with the Southern Christian leadership, SCLC, but he was not directly involved with them. I believe he's from New York. He his reasoning for being in Washington, D.C., is he has spent a lot of great deal of time in Washington, D.C. He actually attended Howard University himself. It was he and I believe it was he and H. Rap Brown was his name at the time, who actually changed the course of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee as far as their relationship with quote unquote white allies, to suggest that if you white people are sincere, then organize with other white people. And in turn, he was kind of like recruited by the Black Panther Party at one time. But also there was some opposition, I believe, from the standpoint that the Black Panther Party did have a relationship with these quote-unquote white radicals. SDF was the Antifa of today at the time, and Mr. Carmichael had a different understanding of quote-unquote white people who are radicals. He was verbally and physically organizing against the Vietnam War early in its time, before the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King also. Matter of fact, he was assisting and encouraging Dr. King to say something against the war in Vietnam. And last but not least, as far as my reference with him, he did attend, and I heard him speak live when I was a sophomore or junior in college at Langston University. He came to the campus and spoke for a couple hours. And so I'm not surprised if any white person would have comments on Mr. Carmichael. That's it. Thank you.
Much obliged, retired firefighter. Let's see. Other folks who dialed in, if you have a hand up, commentary to share, proceed.
Good evening. Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
All right. Cool. Good evening, everyone. I tuned in a bit late, so I kind of missed the first part. But I feel like since I've been following this book, The House, like I feel like every time I see the news, it's something about a dog attacking a black person. And it, I feel like it's standing out even more that I'm reading the book White Dog. And that's all I have to say for now. Thanks.
There's been a number of those reports. We played one at the beginning of the program this week for Utah, and one of our listeners wrote in about another incident in St. Louis where they had the whole Ferguson Police Department. It was in the 2014 report about them attacking black people with dogs. So, yeah, it's been – they talked about the Kaepernick incident. Lots of those over the past 2 weeks. We don't have to go back too far. Just since we have been reading this book, yep, a lot of folks have seen – told you while we were in D.C. Anywho, I'll get to some of my notes and then we'll check in again. Let's see. So he's talking about, again, the context. So just to have a white person writing at the time of Dr. King's assassination, what are we focused on? I still haven't really heard any of that. I've heard this long analysis, repeated analysis of Stokely Carmichael. I have heard no analysis of Dr. King, what he was about, him winning a Peace Prize, what his efforts were, the sanitation strike that he was working on in Tennessee at the time of his assassination, like none of that. Just he's dead and niggers are out here looting. Like, and that no count Stokely Carmichael. Like, what? That's your focus after the assassination of Dr. King? Like, okay, Mr. Gary. So then he says, and then his justification for this so-called looting is not, well, maybe they're upset about Dr. King being killed. Maybe, you know, this is their kind of pitiful, primitive response to white supremacy racism and somebody who was trying to solve that problem explicitly being gunned down. No, this is just, you know, we're in super capitalism and they don't have the means, so... This is, and then all this long, eloquent description of the people going out and getting items indiscriminately and all of that, just wow. That's how I would expect a racist to describe a historic moment like this. This is probably in the past 75 years, probably the last 100 years, at least in this part of the world, one of the most important events and things that happened around that. And yeah, and this is your focus, looting niggers and no count Stokely Carmichael. So he says, this continuous provocation is an entirely new phenomenon in our civilization. If only because of the proportions it has taken, it is the equivalent of a call to rape important in the smoking streets through which we are driving. The big grab is on, and no one really cares what he grabs as long as it's possessions. Can you tell me what that long-necked boy with a purposeful, business-like expression on his intellectual-looking face plans to do with the naked store dummy he is carrying under his arm? Somebody has already ripped off the clothes, and all the poor thing's got to offer is a kind of trophy of wax ass and wax tits. Now, that's all together. Now, I read that. Even symbolically, he's just, the way that I think about black people is rapist. That's at least the second or third time that we've heard that in the book, this fear of rape happening. We had the suspicion about the rape in Central Park, or not Central Park, but the rape in the park incident that was talked about before. Consistent association between black males and their penis, genitals, and projection of black males as rapists. And even in this, as though, you know, he has walked off with some white woman. He's got this nude white woman that he's walking off as a trophy with, after he has just mentioned a call to rape. That's the scene that he follows it with. That's what I talked about sequencing a lot. In the same paragraph, I can understand far better the other fellow over there walking away with a load of toilet paper rolls. There's no telling what the future will be made of. That would have been the item to loot during the madness of the past few days, weeks, 2020. I didn't see that. If anybody did, loot toilet paper, good job. Let's see. Next, on one bottom of 121. So, again, he reminds us, Dr. King just been killed. He's just been killed. Do you know who he was? A moment of hesitation, then it comes spontaneous, entirely devoid of any personal knowledge, thinking, or caring. The kid merely comes up with what he must have heard so often. He was an Uncle Tom, talking of Dr. King. While I choke, Red shuts the door and steps on the gas. He was an Uncle Tom, where he talks to these different children, 15, 16-year-old. And he had said before, or I'll get to that point later, but no need to sugarcoat. There are lots of people now who call, lots of black people now who call Dr. King an Uncle Tom, and there was plenty of that while he was alive. Minister Malcolm X participated in that, so no need to, you know, do any thinking. It doesn't matter if he heard this, if this happened exactly. There was quite a bit of that. Again, where's your focus going to be? Is it going to be that a couple of black people called Dr. King an Uncle Tom?
Is that what our focus is going to be a few moments after he's assassinated? Even if this did happen this way, the people that are most to blame for that are white, for sure. You wouldn't have a Dr. King, you wouldn't have an Uncle Tom if you didn't have a system of racism, white supremacy. All right, so we have this incident. Lots of confused victims, allegedly. Maybe this happened, maybe this didn't. He continues right from there. While I choke, Red shuts the door and steps on the gas. He was an Uncle Tom. Coretta King's face passes in front of me, perhaps the most beautiful woman's face that I have seen in my lifetime, in its sorrow and quiet anguish. Something stuck with me about that sentence. A black person being considered beautiful in pain. That something is very sadistic about that, taking pleasure, deriving pleasure, finding beauty in the suffering of others. Again, that's what I said. Where's our focus at? Even what is he talking about? What is he writing about in the midst of this historic moment? This is one of those people get assignments, you know, go ask your grandparents, you know, or uncles or aunts, you know, where they were during the King assassination. And this is what Romain Guerre, this is where I was. This is what I was focused on. Gosh, she looks so beautiful. Mm. Husband just gunned down in her arms. Oh, doesn't she look beautiful? Suffering. Mm. Suffering Negroes. Let's see. And then he comes right what I just said. So a couple three pages down, a face that an immortal picture taken during her husband's funeral revealed to the world. Something necrophilic about that. An expression of dignity in suffering. Dignified suffering, whatever that. I hear that a lot. They talk about that like with the Charleston victims in South Carolina. I have no idea what that phrase means. It just reminded me of one of my favorite films, not White Dog, but Manderley, featuring Danny Glover, where they talk about different types of Negroes. And they say we got dignified Negroes and proud Negroes and singing Negroes and silly Negroes and fighting Negroes and sleeping Negroes. We got all different types of Negroes. And that's what they describe in the book here. We got dignified Negroes. We got suffering Negroes. We got angry Negroes. We got sad Negroes. Negroes still the same. I get to more of that when we get to Red's point. He says, Red, there was a lot of black fiendishness directed against King. I don't think I've heard that phrase before. Black fiendishness. I know there was a lot of racist fiendishness directed at Dr. King. They got so many COINTELPRO files on him, he would need a lifetime, maybe two, to read them all. Didn't have any white fiendishness. Just black fiendishness. Does Stokely Carmichael count in some of that black fiendishness? What are they talking about exactly? I know they had a lot of black people who name-called Dr. King. I talked about the black female who stabbed him. I believe that was in New York previously. Talked about, is that what he's talking about? Black fiend. I don't know what he's talking about exactly. Again, the main fiendishness was racist man, racist woman, racist child. But this is the second time in the book where they talk about black people, maybe a black person killed Dr. King. Maybe that's what happened. Are you serious? In a system of white supremacy racism? They continue. Black fiendishness directed against King. You don't think that the murderer could be a nigger? Yes, could be. But niggers are all the white man's work. We're blacks. You've turned some of us into niggers. This is what Red says. Something about that just rang very inauthentic. To me, it even struck me as one of those passages where white people get an opportunity to call black people niggers. But since you can say, well, I'm quoting this person, or I didn't say it, Red said it in this alleged conversation. All right, but continuing. And then he gets into his Carmichael. At least in my view, it would kind of be irrelevant whether his analysis is accurate or not about Carmichael. It would be important only because this is such a disparaging analysis, rife with name-calling even, which is just insufferable from anybody, but particularly to have a white person to sit around and name-call a black person. Like, you got to be joking. And then the context, that is the prime. If we were just doing this any old time, we want to sit around and offer his thoughts on Stokely Carmichael, like, oh, okay. If it was accurate, just say, oh, okay, you're still a race soldier, but okay. This is literally moments after the assassination of Dr. King. Why is this the time? I want to take the next 5 minutes to give my analysis of what a coon Stokely Carmichael is.
What in the world? I mean, wow, is there a better time from this, from a white man? Makes no sense to me unless we're here to practice racism. Bill Clinton, is this the time that I want to talk about what a no-count person Stokely Carmichael is at John Lewis's funeral? Tacky white man. Tacky racist. Let's see. Let me make myself clear. Carmichael is the kind of enemy a white superiority establishment should cherish and strive to protect. His total rejection of, in his own terms, everything that is white, including the Marxist and therefore white doctrine orientation of the Black Panthers, is an extremely comfortable cop-out. I have no idea what that is. I have no idea what that means, so-called cop-out. Is what position can you take that would make you safe from racist white supremacists? I'll put it that way, since he said Mr. Carmichael should be a cherished enemy that whites should strive for. What position can you take where that would be the case? I'm clueless. If somebody knows one, let me know, because I thought Herman Cain just passed away, and I wouldn't even know what to tell you. They talk bad about Clarence Thomas all the time, talk bad about President Obama. I have no idea what would be a safe position to take where white people would cherish and protect you. Next. He says, talking about Carmichael, he suddenly rose above the melee, the blood, and the jails to the perfectly harmless and safe heights of the all that is white is unacceptable position. What position can any non-white person take in the world that would be perfectly harmless, especially if you're going to talk about racism? What position would that be, particularly at a time where they're killing black people in the middle of the street in broad daylight? And maybe we catch you, maybe we don't. I guess that'd be still the case now, but what position would that be that's safe? Let's see. Carmichael's facile and no doubt fruitful anti-Semitism. I thought he was talking about Nick Cannon for a second, or Professor Griff, or Jesse Jackson. Forgot it's Louis Farrakhan. So I got confused. The anti-Semitic Negro. We got that. We got dignified Negroes. We got angry Negroes. We got sad Negroes. We got anti-Semitic Negroes. Forgot that one. That is an important category. He's anti-Semitic and susceptible to holding a platform that is about gaming niggers. We had gaming whitey before, and now we have gaming niggers. See, and that's what I mean, because he's got gaming niggers in quotes, but he doesn't have. Who says that? Is that like a line? Is that a chapter in Ready for Revolution? I don't remember that. Gaming niggers. Who even says that? Gaming niggers. That's why I said some of this just strikes me as Gary Romaine. You've already shown me you have a very low opinion of black people, just how you use the word black. You want to call us niggers? I prefer that. In fact, it's about the same thing. The listener said that. I said that before. It's all the same thing. Might as well just be saying niggers the whole time. Next. Okay, now. When he comes to give this anecdote about Stokely Carmichael, he makes a point of saying, appearance of Carmichael, wait a minute, okay, the scenario may be summarized as follows. Appearance of Carmichael in the street among the young rioters. He goes into a department store and orders the staff to leave and close shop. He walks back into the street, and here again, I am quoting the Black Reporter. Now, you are an award-winning writer. If you're going to quote the black right and you're going to make a point, hey, I don't want you all thinking that I pulled one. I'm quoting a black reporter. What's her name? What's the publication? You could give us a date, right? None of that is present. He's got the quotes, and someone pointed that out before. I think it was a female caller that just spoke. He's got a lot of quotation marks in this book. Not one citation, and I mean, wowee, I spent a lot of time grousing about that in our last book. No references. You for sure think I'm going to bring up the same thing here, that you're going to tell me and make a point of telling me. Oh, no. You don't have to take my word. Look at what this here Negro journalist said. Who? Where? Footnote? Something? You're just going to put quotes around something. I think you could be making this whole incident up. And I mean, Stokely Carmichael is kind of a well-known Negro, especially at this time, so there's
probably not just a black reporter's account of this. If all of this went down and they're talking about guns coming out in the street, like, this might have got picked up at least by the local press, too. Anywho, so he goes through this whole incident, gun out, blah, blah, blah. Maybe it happened, maybe it didn't. Blah, blah, blah. So we skip down. He says, the verbal violence so infuriating to whites not merely reduced the need for physical violence. I would stop right there. The system of white supremacy is all about violence. When you look back at the 1960s when all this was happening, 68, 69, all of this is being written. The lie is right in what the time period, the context. Again, that's why I said it doesn't even matter whether he's accurate or not about Stokely Carmichael. Dr. King was just killed. Why are we not talking about that? Why is it this no-count Stokely Carmichael? And let me go back and give you some accounts of what a no-count coon Stokely Carmichael is. Why is that at this time? No, the rhetoric didn't stop violence. Dr. King would still be alive if that was the case. Fred Hampton would still be alive, killed 1 year later, along with a lot of other black people who died. No, that's not true at all. The system of white supremacy is about constant, and again, Vietnam right in the background. This is a global system. You got non-white people being killed all the time. There's no such thing as violence being stopped or no need for physical violence. That's every day, all the time. Let's see. How many whites have black radicals actually killed over the years, including the police and politically motivated aggression? Pause. Mark Essex has a song, member of the Black Panther Party. We talked about him on the program many times. He went and did exactly what he just described, killed a number of New Orleans police officers. There was retribution. White people deliberately, white people like Romaine Gary, deliberately will go and erase events where black people have done exactly what he just said, went out and said racism, white supremacy is a problem, I'm going to kill as many race soldiers as possible. That has happened since the beginning of racism. Thus far, it has proved insufficient. I'm not sure if he's advocating that this be done. I'm not sure if he's mocking black people like, oh, they're so impotent. They Stokely Carmichaels and the Black Panthers, they go out with all this tough rhetoric. Even Red, his so-called black friend, they go out with all their militant, childish rhetoric. And who have they really killed? That's the same thing Carruthers said. Who have they killed? I'm not scared of these niggers. Got my white dog here. All right. But you did have a number of black people who were serious about that. Mark Essex. Even today, Nkosi Thondaway, number of black people have retaliated. It has been woefully insufficient thus far. White people are the master killers, hands down. White people kill for fun. So he continues, all in the same paragraph here. How many have they actually killed? But it succeeded in giving the young blacks a feeling of total psychological equality with the whites. He has that in italics. I don't know if that's a quote. I don't know why it's in italics. I don't even know what that means. Psychological equality, the people who go around the world and don't just talk about killing people, but they kill lots of people. In fact, what did we just have? The 75-year, they make anniversaries of killing people. Remember when we dropped that bomb on all them slopes, all them Japs? Remember when we killed it? I said, bah, 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 made a, and show videos of it, right? They brag about that. How are you so-called psychologically equal by just sitting around and saying, burn, baby, burn? That doesn't even make sense. Continuing, this is the black revolution that has actually taken place. The rest may be even more difficult to achieve, but at least the civil rights battle won't be fought by losers. No idea what that means. Far from provoking massacres, where are they? The incendiary verbal violence of the ghetto leaders removes the need for physical violence. Saying the same thing again, which I just said, total lie. We're writing this as Dr. King has not even been buried yet. What is called ghetto rhetoric? Who even uses that term? Is that what they called? I don't remember that. Ghetto rhetoric stems from the psychological need to dare. It's not simply letting off steam. It is taking your testicles off the hock. The symbolism, Dr. Francis Cresswell, what did I just say? It gets to the genital level so quickly. What a metaphor. Let's see. He says, this is continuing the conversation with Red, while unquestionably saving the kid's life. So he's talking about Stokely Carmichael, the gun incident, allegedly. Saves white lives as well, and yet the purpose has been achieved and a major psychological battle won. There are very few young niggers left in America today and very few young Toms. He has both of these terms in quotes, but he doesn't give a definition as to what either of these terms mean. What exactly does it mean to be a so-called Tom in a system of white supremacy, and what does it mean to be a so-called nigger? If you're a victim, subject to racists at all, you're a nigger and a Tom. Just following logic. Let's see. So then he goes at Red, even if you get 25,000 black Vietnam pros in your ranks, there'll still be 100,000 Vietnam pros facing them. The face is all closed. I had never seen him sad before, and although all the black sadness went into the blues or was swallowed long ago, have you met any sad black kids recently? Whatever you may have read in their expression, it wasn't sadness, I bet. Sadness, that was the niggers. Again, no idea what this means. To me, it's totally irrelevant if it happened or not. I have no idea what that means. Again, if you are a subject in any way to whites, you are a nigra, and that is something to be sad about. Many black people are very, very sad and should be about being victims of racism. Chapter 12. All that was chapter 11, chapter 12. Son of a bitch used quite a bit here as well. Lots of references, I think, some of the other callers. The white dog is Romaine Gary. The white dog is white people. That's the same conclusion I think you would come to watching the film. It's different here, different presentation, but same conclusion. Same reason that I think both are outstanding representations of what it means to be white. Let's see. Students for Democratic Society. We actually had a member of Students for Democratic Society on the program. Bill Ayers was a guest back in 2009. We talked about some of his writing. Instead of being one of these woolly-headed liberals from the 1960s, at least at the time we interviewed him in 2009, he was a distinguished professor, and that was his exact title, distinguished professor. At the University of Illinois. And this fellow was running around bombing federal buildings. He was on the FBI's most wanted list in the 1970s. Bill Ayers was. And now he's a distinguished professor. Anyway, I thought it was important when they go into this whole scene where the young members of SDS come and they want to get the white dog and set him on fire. She starts off talking about how the lead speaker for the group is a strikingly handsome fellow. And I feel like that happens a number of times in this book, where black people are very rarely described positively. I can only really think Coretta Scott King talking about how beautiful she is after her husband has been murdered. Doesn't she look beautiful at the funeral morning? That's it. Everybody else. And I think he had a trashy, sexy line about how some black female had the greatest ass in the world. Other than that, they get described as animals. He says they're menacing. You find some sort of menacing scowl on the look of every black person. They look like Malcolm X. He said that repeatedly. He says Keyes has all these teeth in his mouth and doesn't even look human. That's the way that he describes black people. When he starts talking about white people, any white person, even the white dog, they're intelligent and smart. He says when he's talking about Crucian salts, which is a real advertisement. You can look online and see the advertisements for Crucian salts, and you'll see like an older-looking white guy who does look a little bit about like this character if you see the film. But he talks about Crucian salts being this great guy, and this is like the foundation of the world and what makes things go around. And he loves this guy. Same way he talks about Gene Seberg is so beautiful. He does this repeatedly throughout the book where any and all the white people, even the flagrantly racist white people, get described intelligent, handsome, really positive terms, way different than the way that he describes any of the black people in the book. Let's see. So they get to the end, and they get described as woolly-headed liberals. I think woolly-headed might be in the word God. I know even Minister Malcolm talked about that, like woolly-headed. Who do they talk about as being woolly-headed? Okay. Continuing, let's see. He says America started out as democracy. What happens here is the world. I thought they started out with niggers here in shackles. Did I miss that? Was that Virginia? Maybe I got confused. I need to do a little bit more history on this part of the world. Let's see. When he gets to the part where Baca escapes and goes to the baby carriage, this is duplicated in the film because he says, I'm paralyzed with fear holding my shopping bags under my arms, my whole body turned into ice. In the film, there's a moment where white dog attacks a black female, and actually it happens repeatedly. White dog attacks a black female, and then later on, white dog attacks a black male, and both times this happens where the white owner is there, doesn't do anything, doesn't even move, so-called paralyzed with fear. I think that is an extremely important metaphor where white people, they observe and or participate in white supremacy racism all the time and don't do anything. If they're not participating in them, in themselves directly, they are not doing a thing. They just say, oh, my goodness, look at what is happening to the niggers. Oh, get a little bit more. Like that sort of thing happens all the time. But bingo, you got it right there. And, I mean, this is a child. It's not, oh, Lord, I threw the eggs down. I sprinted. I tackled the dog. I shot the dog. You know, that appropriate response. Nope. Oh, Lord. Oh, I was shaking. I was clutching the broccoli so tight. I hope he doesn't jump on the little nigglet. That's Romaine Gary. I believe this one the way I believe that one. I think that's just how it happened. Let's see. Oh, and that's it. Okay. We'll have to pick up with the rest of it there. Let's see. Let's double check, see if any other folks dialed in have comments, thoughts that they would like to share. Let's see. Any folks that either had a hand up, comments that they want to share, or are we going pushing off to our second audio segment? We have about 6 minutes if you have anything you want to get in. If not, we can wait and read more. Everybody satisfied? Grant, we will push off. As I said, there will be more commentary about the dog's interaction with a black child. That's going to come up pretty directly in the segment that we're about to read right now. So we'll get to that. And, yeah, we'll have a little bit more from Keys as well. So lots more to chew on as we proceed. Might even be more Stokely Carmichael coming up after double check. So this is Romaine Gary, White Dog. Wowee. Context of white supremacy. We'll go ahead and get started with audio segment number two.
I'll tell you one thing, Gary. Americans have a way of changing my perfectly Russian name, Gary, meaning burn in Russian, as in burn, baby, burn, into a typically American Gary, by shifting the accent from the second to the first syllable. My ego thus feels the humiliation of being reduced to the lowest common denominator of American first names. I'll tell you, Gary, you have no use for animals. Ask my friends if that's true. I don't care. That dog's become an abstraction for you. Some kind of crappy symbol. I knew from the start that was what was going to happen. The same goes for Keys. You intellectuals. You're catching. Oh, come off that intellectuals talk, Jack. If you can't stand intellectuals, get yourself elected mayor of Los Angeles. You've got to overbid everything. That's what's with your brainy group. You've got to make everything up into a bigger issue. You've got to generalize, and it's contagious. Keyes was an honest-to-God, white-hating black Muslim, but you've gotten on his brain with your abstractions. Rubbish. He pauses a while, then shakes his head and says with almost grudging admiration, "The son of a bitch! Never saw a more determined guy. He scared the shit out of me. Listen to this." One balmy day, Carruthers had driven up to the ranch along Magnolia, and although most of the zoo is hidden by thick, tall, pink and white laurel bushes, you can see the kennel from the boulevard with Botka's cage in the foreground. You can also see waltzing Mathilda, the giraffe. Nothing seems more lovely than a giraffe when it's there all by itself with that long watchtower neck rising above the horizon, and the entrance to the snake pit adorned with a huge warning sign in red, "We are a bunch of deadly snakes, and we don't like you either. Keep out." The chimpanzee's villa is a little farther away to the right. It is more luxurious than the rest of this little residential zone, as some of the chimps under contract to studios are at the top of their profession among the stars of the big and small screen, and Jack feels he has to give them a certain social edge over the others. Jack had crossed Vale and was about to make a turn toward the entrance when he almost crashed into a fire hydrant. He had caught sight of Botka, and there was a black baby sitting alone with the dog in the middle of the cage. He stopped the car, grabbed the burning cigar that had fallen into his lap, and shot through the ranch entrance. A minute later, he was in the cage. It was then that he realized that the child had not gotten into the cage by accident, but had been deliberately left there. Botka was held back by a chain and the child by a belt tied to the bars. There was no danger at all. Jack didn't know Key's family, and he didn't know at the time that the child was his precious snake and venom specialist's son. He let go with a terrible roar out of a sheer feeling of relief, no doubt. When Jack swears, it's something. And I am not only talking folklore, it's more like a whole culture complete with world outlook, solid religion, and literary background, with mothers playing a very strong part in that unquestionable gift for strong imagery. All of those within reach of his voice ran up immediately, and Keyes was first on the spot. He had raced up so fast that he still held a snake wrapped up around his forearm, with the head sticking out of the man's fist. He had been busy extracting the venom and hadn't had time to put the reptile back in the pit. He was standing there in front of Jack with the snake opening and closing its mouth above the clenched fist. A pleasant confrontation altogether. And while they yelled at each other, Jack learned that Keyes had been putting his son in White Dog's cage every day God has made for more than a week. I must confess that while he was telling me all this, the first explanation of Keyes' motives, or rather, the first suspicion that came to me, was the same that had crossed Carruthers' mind. And it wasn't much to the credit of either of us. The suspicion was that Keyes was deliberately training his son, and that the purpose was to accustom him to the showing of hate. Botka, in one of his fits of white rage, was a frightening sight, and in that perversion of logic which always occurs when psychology parades in reason's disguise,
both of us concluded that Keys was thinking of his son and not of the dog, and that he had put the kid inside the cage to expose him to the sight of hate and to train him to feel used to it and impervious to it. It would be only too easy to accuse me here of being a writer given to flights of dark imagination. The same suspicion had crossed Carruthers' mind and explained his fit of rage. Both of us were wrong, but it tells quite a bit about the depth of what America is up against. The truth of the matter was the simple fact that Keys knew dogs well. A dog, particularly a big, strong animal, sure of himself, always feels protective toward all small living things, particularly mammals. He either shows them indifference and condescension, or an ironic paternal superiority. The child ran no risk at all, but even so, his father had taken the precaution of tying up both dog and kid to keep them apart. At first, I put the kid outside the cage, he explained. The dog was real friendly from the start. I kept at it for a few days, then as Chuck wanted to play with the doggie, "What's the idea?" Jack asked. Keys studied him for a while, then smiled. Jack was to tell me, "No, you can't say he was staring at me. He was aiming between the eyes." Keys said, "I want the dog to get used to our smell." Jack told me, "I had this sudden urge to hit him. He was deliberately giving it to me, taking it out on me. That's it. Just spitting in my white face, and I don't care if it's white. I care that it's a human face. But what the hell was I to an answer? When you knew the part that bit about smell has played and still plays in segregation, in buses, in cafeterias, in the whole goddamn racial bullshit." He had me there. There was nothing I could say. I had to swallow it. "Now we've made it," Keys said. "You can go into that cage and untie them. The dog will be happy, and the kid too. There's no risk. I know about the insurance. Sure I do. I take full responsibility. Go ahead. If you're nutty enough, go and do it yourself." Keys held out his hand. "Here, take it." Jack grabbed the snake lightning quick. "In such a situation, my friend," he explained to me, "you have to act real fast and get hold of them in the right place, and I'm sure if I'd shown a trace of hesitation, that fiend would have just thrown the snake into my arms. I was too busy watching the twister to think of stopping this devil I'm paying $200 a week." None of us knew that Keys had already managed to become real buddies with your mutt, except perhaps that kid Terry, who looked as if he was going to die laughing. Some joke. I've never really learned to like snakes, you know? So I guess I didn't look my best right then, with that black twisting piece of hate in my fist. Well, Keys went inside the cage, untied the dog and the kid, and you would have thought they were one big happy family. Friendly as hell. I wish you'd have been there. You would have loved the sight, Gary. This big reconciliation, universal love, your line exactly. I can't say I felt overjoyed. I'd been proved wrong, though I have a lifetime of experience with animals. I never would have believed you could change an old, well-trained police dog like that. Never saw it done before. Well, I was proved wrong. Yep, let's put this away. There's a new generation of dog handlers on their way up.
I guess Keyes has a great future ahead of him in the field. Anyway, you'll be happy to know there are idyllic scenes between man and beast going on in that cage out there. A regular Garden of Eden. The snakes are the only ones left who won't play ball. They just aren't very trusting. Neither am I. Why don't you go out there and warm your heart a bit? I must have looked as moved as if beauty and love descended upon earth, holding hands to the sound of a heavenly choir. Your Keyes is quite a guy. Admittedly, no one can claim to be able to read a man's thoughts in the look he gives you, but Jack's expression was so eloquent and explicit that it clearly said, "Here's one of the biggest suckers that has ever lived." At the other end of the room, Miss Beau let out the groan of a Victorian lady in childbirth. You really have to have preserved deep down inside you some blessed trace of the 8-year-old kid you once were to be able to experience the delight I felt when I saw the black man sitting on the ground busily looking for ticks on Vodka's belly. The dog was lolling on his back in a trance of voluptuousness, his mouth open in something like a smile of sheer bliss. Keyes raised his eyes, gave me a "Hi there," and turned back to his love affair. Scene of peace and friendship. Eucalyptus trees, little birds singing. Idyllic sweetness of air and light. Peace and quiet at last. There were some hens clucking around the cage. White hens. You can get really nutty in this country. Vodka remained on his back, but turned his head a bit toward me, opened an eye, and gave me a polite wag of the tail. That dog was smiling. I have known 2 or 3 dogs in my life who actually smiled, and Vodka is one of them. It consists in half baring the teeth while the lower part of the muzzle twitches. Skalitsa is the Russian word for it, in case you wish to know the exact word. "Well, you've done it," I say. Keyes goes on rubbing the dog's belly. "Not quite yet." "You can't do better than that." "Oh, yes, I can," he says. His eyes go over the dog, who looks like a full-bosomed beauty falling asleep after a good rub-down. "He's a fine animal. Real bright." I can still see him, here, before my eyes, even now, in my home in Mallorca, where I am writing this, and though a year has gone by and so many things have happened, his presence, far from fading away, looms larger and larger until it takes on almost mythological proportions. I doubt I shall ever forget him. One of those narrow-hipped, lanky Americans who grow taller than the rest of us through some secret virtue of American soil. A narrow mustache above very thin lips with their hint of some far-off Spanish blood and the kind of blank look that doesn't expect anything from you and has nothing to offer in the way of trust, sympathy, or rancor. It's a look which keeps everything under wraps and doesn't come out to meet you. The structure of the face has that hacked-out-of-stone quality which makes up for the almost feminine delicacy of the features and gives it a brooding, sullen tenseness, and the studied, deliberate absence of expression emphasizes the granite immobility bordering on ruthlessness, which is described as savage in reference to African warriors and as noble with crusaders or Napoleon's marshals. On his hand, gray scars from snake bites.
Tatum told me that this strange man had an almost magical immunity, that he was completely immune to the venom of all American snakes. Maybe he's got some kind of secret, you know? The old man had added with a wrinkled grin. From father to son, special herbs, that kind of thing. But it was only an acquired immunity which involved the interaction of serums with progressive resistance resulting from snake bites. I have seen him stand in the pit in a mass of writhing snakes, extracting a reptile's venom while it twisted and lashed its tail in his fist. Pity it's so much more difficult with people. He stood over the pit and the snakes with an air of indifference, as if merely performing a chore, and yet it was difficult for me not to feel that he was rising victoriously, that here was a black American who had become invulnerable. He leans over the dog and scratches his belly. Vodka closes his eyes in happiness. I watch the scene with a smile wet with emotion, a smile that seems to have inherited all the humidity of Victorian handkerchiefs. The dog's got a long way to go yet, Keyes observes. Sure, he accepts me. I'm the one who feeds him. I take him out for runs. I look after him. I scratch his belly. I take good care of him. He can afford to be nice with me. I'm his house nigger. My smile breaks up, and there's no picking up the bits. There is nothing you can do with that son of a bitch. He is beyond help. You can't even say he's got a chip on his shoulder. It's more like some sort of total historic recall. Do you remember exactly what a house nigger was? He was a black servant who was a part of the household, served his masters devotedly, and took care of their children. In exchange, his masters were nice to him, often considered him almost as one of the family, and assured him of a privileged situation among the other slaves, the field niggers. I've often heard militants use this expression in talking about blacks who have succeeded in white society and secured a high position for themselves within the establishment. I'm his house nigger. Keyes comes out of the cage. He lights a cigarette, inhales the smoke dreamily, and throws away the match. Then suddenly, without looking at me, how about giving me the dog? For keeps, I mean. You'll be better off having him off your hands, and I'd like to have him. Why is it so important to you? He keeps on staring. Well, I put a lot of myself into this business, you know. Took lots of time and patience. I say cautiously, I can't promise you anything. I'll talk it over with Jean. I drive slowly back over the hills and down the canyon, passing from eucalyptus to palm trees, looking down on what is left of the once magnificent wilderness with its wide and bleeding ochre wounds left by bulldozers. To hell with Keyes. No point in brooding over a hostility so haunting that it seems to be following me. I pull up in front of the house of Stas, my poor builder of ideal cities, with a do-it-yourself kit. They tell me his days are numbered and that he hangs on to life by a sheer miracle of tenacity. I am convinced it is his determination to complete the building of his city of light that keeps him alive. Chapter 14. A young black opens the door of the little house on stilts buried deep within the thick green vegetation of Laurel Canyon. I find Stas in his bed, sitting in front of the City of Light.
it has grown impressively since my last visit. The Palace of Culture, the workers' homes, the museums, the universities, the recreation centers, the trade union headquarters, the parks, and a building called the Permanence of Liberty, the writers and artists' quarter, the stadiums and the theaters look splendid. Only the Universal Church still seems to be hesitating between different architectural styles. With its minarets, domes, spears, and symbols uniting the cross, the hammer, and sickle, and other more or less obscure emblems, it looks as if it were ready to take on almost anything while actually producing a depressing effect of emptiness. Stas has gotten terribly thin. Dressed in a gay psychedelic bathrobe, which seems to mock the ghostly pallor of his face, he stares thoughtfully at his work. He appears glad to see me and watches rather anxiously for a sign of appreciation as I inspect his personal Brasilia. Great, I say. There aren't quite enough prisons, though, and your stadium should be surrounded by a wire fence. Right now, in France anyway, most football games degenerate into murderous scrimmages. You really ought to protect the ball. I learn from him that the young black man who keeps him company is wanted by the police. He walked in at that very moment with a thermos full of tea. Stas drinks tea almost continuously, driven by a terrible thirst which is characteristic of his sickness. Alec, as he is introduced to me, holds the examiner in his hand and begins to talk with a high-pressure volubility that is more liberating for him, no doubt, than informative for me. The object of his wrath is two lines in the paper informing the public that a liquor store has been held up by two men. Both were wounded and arrested. Their names are given, and Stas's young protege knows them. He is indignant because the newspaper passes over in silence the fact that the two aggressors are blacks. The press keeps the wraps on. No reference is made to color because the publicity might help us. The idea is to make our revolutionary action look like jive gangsterism without reference to color so as not to give our people pride. We're going to demand that every time a crime is committed by the brothers, the papers say it's blacks who struck out. We'll blow up their offices if necessary. They're fucking careful not to mention color. They say John Smith, and that's that. Why? To keep our strength hidden from the black masses. That's why. They might feel encouraged, you see, and they might even want to help us. He sneers, his face covered with sweat. He is sitting on a packing case drinking one cup of tea after another. I catch myself thinking that I've never seen a black drink so much tea just like a Russian. He's got the shivers, and I know that tense, feverish expression, the aggressiveness, the drops of sweat. It is the face of fear. 75% of what they call crimes are carried out by our brothers. We want this to be known, but the pig press deliberately avoids any mention of color because they know damn well every single one of these crimes is guerrilla action, and they don't want to drive that fact home because they don't want us to get the benefit of publicity. I catch my breath. Good God, the tacit code of the American press for at least 40 years has been never to mention the ethnic origin of a criminal. Whenever the code was broken by some reactionary sheet, the liberals denounced this as racism. Now, the Che Guevara syndrome is inverting the process. the truly lunatic fringe of the extremists is trying to cash in politically on every black rapist, thief, or murderer and make revolutionary capital of their actions. Anything that is simply the work of hoods is christened rebellion and terrorism. Nice idea, in theory. Clever stratagem in the self-deluding paranoia of the state of siege, but it has one major inconvenience. It works the other way around, by turning all common criminals into fighters and heroes. All true fighters and heroes are made to look like common criminals. I say to Stas in Polish, Zwarzywal, all out nut. My poor friend, the knight of our radiant tomorrows, mumbles into his limply drooping blonde mustache that looks like Sandy's yellow tail. He's in serious trouble just now. Very bad. Please try to show some sympathy for once. I look at this raving cat without listening to him, which helps me to see him better. He is sweating like hell, and contrary to what I thought, it is not the effect of the hot tea he keeps swallowing. His eyes are wide and frozen, in contrast to the constantly moving lips. He's going through a bad time, Stas mumbles, close to a nervous breakdown. Anything interesting? Stas disapproves of my hostility, which is nothing but the effect of the other fellow's open hatred for me. It's catching. Stas lowers his eyes and feeds his soul on the site of the Palace of Culture at the heart of his future paradise on Earth. He doesn't answer. I feel loved and trusted here, I mumble. One thing is clear, the black cat is in a state of absolute panic, engulfed in a tidal wave of terror. You can't keep him in this condition, Stas. You ought to call a doctor and give him tranquilizers. Don't talk nonsense. He is right. A white man offering tranquilizers to a black activist, that would be an insult, like not taking him seriously. I mean, telling him he is not Che Guevara, but a nervous wreck. The trouble with hysteria is that it's contagious. This kind of high-pitched, all-out aggressive hostility bounces back and forth like a ping-pong ball. I feel my anger rising for no reason at all, no other reason than the atmosphere of hostility in which I feel immersed. I emphasize this sentence because it helps to understand how unbalance in others throws you off balance yourself, how emotional frenzy spreads, snowballs, grows beyond all reason without any link between cause and effect until it becomes sheer beastliness. My breathing gets faster and faster. My mouth is dry. I have to make an effort to control myself, and there is no reason for this rising tension, which is already looking for release, a pretext for a liberating blow-up. The kook must read something mean and nasty in my narrowed eyes because he throws me the classic bullshit of all racists, xenophobes, chauvinists, and other condescending guardians of a privileged exclusive out of bounds for foreigners rare and profound knowledge. You can't understand this anyway. You aren't an American. So you yourself feel 100% American, after all? How can you lack compassion to that degree? Stas mumbles in Polish. I'm supposed to turn the other cheek? You talking about me? He watches us suspiciously. I am choking. Sure, I've had enough of treating every raving black with the solicitude do a pregnant woman? Why don't you go take a nice walk in the garden? Stas suggests tactfully. I get a grip on myself. Well, I make a good try anyway. But the guy keeps aiming his nervous tics at me, sneers of sheer hate, and I'm telling you, it's catching. I begin to feel those insect-like zigzags running over my face as if ripples of hate were jumping from him to me. We sit there a while, our minds filled with fist fights and kicks in the ass, our nervous twitches bouncing back and forth from one to the other. Che, che, cha, 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 I growl. What was that? My voice is high-pitched, not like my voice at all. First of all, if you hate liberals, as all you real fighters do, what the hell are you doing sitting here under the roof of a notorious liberal pants-wetting sucker? He throws me a real super tick, and I send one right back, a beaut. He looks for his voice somewhere deep in his knotted throat and comes up hoarsely with that emergency exit formula known to all trapped smart-ass dialecticians. That's his problem. Merde, say I. He swallows his Adam's apple, and I swallow a pint of saliva. If he wants to help us, that's his business. He knows we're using him. Right, Stas says, as masochistic as a chamber pot. You liberals get a kick from helping us. It makes you feel good, getting rid of guilt. By helping us, you really help yourself. We don't owe you shit. Your creep is so full of crap, it's like Little Red Riding Hood reading the Little Red Book. My voice sounds as if a strangler were at my throat. My body is rigid with anger and a desperate, almost paranoid resentment amounting to self-pity, directed against myself to boot, and that means the I of all human situations and predicaments, the I that cannot be accepted much longer in its subhuman, prehistoric, barbaric, humiliating indignity gets hold of me and ends up in a Nazi-like urge to punish the whole blind herd for the unbearable fact that I am part of it, an almost physical craving for total alienation and transcendence, an idiotic aspiration to break with all that is human so as to realize the impossible, to become a man at last. And, as is usually the case with me, when my mind lashes out in search of a shortcut to some total self-expression, it jumps elliptically over the hurdles of coherent thinking. It all comes out in one sentence, flashing through my brain. They have no right to do this to a dog. Self-pity, yes, and it reminds me of Sandy's nasal whine. This young man is in very great danger, Stas murmurs. Please remember that. Police? No. I shall never know if Stas, may peace be with him in that true city of light he now inhabits, no doubt, still busily planning a better and more openly democratic paradise, with its green pastures more equitably shared. I shall never know if Stas was himself fully aware of the nightmare which entrapped the young man he was sheltering. Wanted by the police was actually a police spread rumor for the purpose of establishing the reputation of an informer. I have no right to claim this as certitude as the whole game of guessing who's in the FBI, black power struggle, is by its very nature based on falsehood, slander, and paranoia. I may be completely wrong. I only heard the poor guy's name once. I am almost sure it was Rackley, It may have been Wrigley or something like that. I am only certain of the first name. It was Alec or Alex, and the body of an Alex Rackley, 23, with marks of torture on it, cigarette burns, boiling water burns, multiple deep cuts, was found in Connecticut in the spring of 1969. In August of the same year, Bobby Seale, chairman of the Black Panthers, was arrested and accused of having ordered the murder. Alex Rackley was an FBI informer, or so the police claimed, and Bobby Seale, according to the police again, had taken part in the interrogation of the young man conducted along the line of our own methods of la question practiced by both the French army in Algeria and by the Fellahin. Rackley had been a member of the Black Panthers for only 8 months. The dates coincide, and if it was indeed the same young man, both his neurotic condition and the fanatical militant overbiding of his talk appear in quite a different light. He had just made the no-return plunge to treason. But his actual identity, the importance of the fact that this was or was not the Alex Rackley of the case, is only relative. From whatever angle you look at the Black Panthers' situation, you will find nothing but provocation, infiltration, informing, a kill-em-all state of siege, repression, and suffering. The Black organization most hated by the police is by far the least numerous. At a minimal cost in white lives, once more I am asking here a question: how many whites have they killed? 10? 15? This strident, ridiculously small group of men and women has achieved more in the all-important task of giving young blacks a feeling of psychological equality and of breaking completely the process of psychological castration than any movement you can think of in America. That fact is apparent to anyone who is in contact with the young. Those who wish to kill off the Black Panthers to a man will never be able to deprive them of this victory. It has already been achieved, and from the dry, cold point of view of history, what can happen now to the Black Panthers is not important. Never before has a smaller group of men achieved more and at a smaller cost in terms of actual bloodshed. The poisonous, sickening atmosphere in which the militants live goes beyond the Rackley case, typical as it may be. For what is even more typical is that there was another stool pigeon involved, a certain George Sams Jr., 23, who testified against Bobby Seale, and that raises even more fascinating questions and possibilities. How to get the Panthers' leaders' hides? How to get them clean and proper without always shooting through a door at a sleeping man. All it takes is a bit of smart thinking. You put an informer to work, and then you use another informer to tell on the first one. From then on, everything takes care of itself. Old routine, centuries-tested mechanics. Tradition. In fact, nothing like it. Was Rackley deliberately sacrificed by those who employed him? I wish to make once more absolutely clear, you have been warned, that I am not, repeat, not, dealing with facts here. No Panther ever talked to me of this matter, and I have no more access to their files on the police than to Mr. Hoover's files on black radicals. I am not formulating accusations. My purpose is to convey at least a small impression of the poisoned, sick, treacherous atmosphere of suspicion, provocation, uncertainty, and continuous state of siege in which the Black Panthers live and work, yes, work, and it is probably the most successful group therapy undertaken in the long struggle against deliberate psychological crippling, maiming, and snickering friendly persuasion. I came out of the house sickened, exasperated, and guilty. I should have kept a firmer grip on my leash. But the passion is contagious, whatever its cause, and what the young call bad vibrations are catching. Besides, my nerves were shot, and you have to be in a perfectly balanced nervous condition not to be thrown off balance by unbalanced types. What I had really gone through was an experience of psychological backlash. I was beginning to feel like the kind of white who has had enough of the black problem, which gave me a teeny-weeny hint of how the blacks themselves must feel. If I were black, the very mention of the black problem would drive me amok, and yet I believe the problem has no future in America simply because I believe America has a future. Back home, with Gene at the studio, I was seized once more by a craving for some magnificent total separation from myself, from that I cannot abide, tolerate, or help. A craving for solitude wholly unprecedented in the history of loneliness. Is it some sort of aristocratic egomania? Does my I feel debased and humiliated by its all-too-human nature? Montaigne's famous words, but are they Montaigne's? Nothing that is human is foreign to me. Words I used to consider noble and inspiring take on a nasty, insulting, cynical meaning. To satisfy such a longing for another and a better planet, you have to create a whole new world, which I proceed to do in my usual comical way. I spend the whole afternoon writing.
That will do us for this week, so we'll pick up next week on Chapter 15. We are slightly over the halfway point in the book, so we should have 3-4 sessions more to go, and then we'll get to our next book. If you have commentary to share, the number to dial, 720-716-7300, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Let's see. We had the remainder of our email commentary. I think I can get to now. Let's see. All right, listener who wrote in. Number 4, so he writes, Carruthers states, Keyes was an honest-to-God, white-hating black Muslim, but you have gotten to his brain with your abstraction. I think Carruthers is inferring that the author has ruined his slave by his influence. Number 5. From the text, the suspicion was that Keyes was deliberately training his son and that the purpose was to accustom him to the showing of hate, to train him to feel used to it and impervious to it. I thought the passage was revealing regarding the true thoughts, fears of racist man. The author and Carruthers. The author and Carruthers were fearful that Keyes was training his son to be codified towards racist, which may be the key to the dismantling the global system of racism, white supremacy. Number 6, the author's long description of Keyes continues the homoerotic references found throughout the text. One of those narrow-hipped, lanky Americans who grow taller than the rest of us through some secret virtue of American soil. A narrow mustache above very thin lips with their hint of some far-off Spanish blood and the kind a blank look that doesn't expect anything from you and has nothing to offer in the way of trust, sympathy, or rancor. It's a look which keeps everything under wraps and doesn't come out to meet you. The structure of the face has that hacked out of the stone quality, which makes up for the almost feminine delicacy of features and gives it a brooding on ruthlessness, which is described by Savage in references to African warriors and as noble with crusaders or Napoleon's marshals. Great reference, the homoeroticism. Number 7. Keys, regarding vodka, he can afford to be nice with me. I'm his house nigga. I thought this demonstrated a level of insight on Keys' part regarding his situation in life as a victim of racism, white supremacy. Absolutely. Chapter 14. Number 1, the author, a young black, opens the door. Again, I thought the use of the word nigger could be substituted for black. For example, if the sentence had been young black male, I may not have thought of it in the same way. Number 2, the section describing the relationship between Stas and Alec brought immediately to mind Ed Buck. Oh, no. The wealthy businessman and Democratic Party fundraiser. He was arrested in 2019, L.A., Los Angeles, after two black males died from drug overdoses in his home, allegedly due to Buck injecting them as a part of some homosexual orgy. The descriptions of Alec in the text suggested to me that he was on drugs. Face covered in sweat, he's got shivers. Feverish expression. Feverish. Number 3, Stas. You liberals get a kick out of helping us. Author, your creep is so full of crap, it's a little like reading Red Riding Hood, reading The Little Red Book, a reference to the Communist China's chairman Mao Zedong's book of speeches and quotations titled The Little Red Book. Another example of the problem with metaphors. I guess the author means that Alec is naive and lacks a depth of understanding regarding his political position. Number 4, Alec is reported by the author to possibly be the Black Panther Alec Rackley, age 23, who in 1969 was murdered by other Black Panthers in Connecticut. Alex Rackley was reportedly an FBI informer, and this is the reason he was murdered. There appears to be some truth in what the author is reporting. Number 5, Black Panthers has achieved more in the all-important task of giving young blacks a feeling of psychological equality and of breaking completely the process of psychological castration than any other movement you can think of in America. The author does not define psychological equality or psychological castration. No matter the definition, either will likely not happen, neither will likely not end the global system of racism, white supremacy. White Dog was a best-selling book. I suspect it was popular in part with suspected racists because of the continual criticism of so-called black leaders. Fascinating text, great addition to the book club. I agree. Let's see. Much obliged for the written commentary. We'll see if other folks dialed in have thoughts, observations to share. If you dialed in and we have missed you totally and you have a hand up, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Fantastic. So I'll add a few things from chapter 11. The description of the rioters recalls to me something that Neely Fuller Jr. says about white behavior being tacky, trashy, or terroristic. And this is an example of being trashy when he speaks about the rioters, because it seems as if he wants to pile on the mistreatment that they have already experienced. For example, when enemies down stomp on them. And I feel like he's been mocking black people for the past couple of chapters. in chapter 12 when he had the quote, "The dog loves everybody," which I consider a lack of loyalty. I think it's important to say that after this talking about the rioters and what happened during the death of Martin Luther King, he's outing himself as someone totally diametrically opposite to Martin Luther King. I don't believe the story with the black baby, and I feel like he was framing his as if he's mocking black men. One reference that I would like to call, I like to call these Wellsin references, where he speaks about Stasi's City of Light. For me, that translated to City of White or City of White People. And I thought it was telling when he said that the model that Stasi was creating needed more prisons. And that he says that immediately before the narrative in the story starts to talk about the young black man who is staying with Stas. And it's interesting how this is like a second example of an older white male having a black male or younger black males together with him, positioned to with him. You have it with Caruthers and Keys, and you have it here with Stas and this young black man. I kept wondering if some of these comments and statements that he was setting up in his narration was actually true. Let's see. You can see a lot of examples of inadequacy and this of alienation when he talked about a Nazi-like urge to punish the whole blind herd for the unbearable fact that I am part of it. An almost physical craving for total alienation and transcendence. Is this what it means to be white? He talks about the importance of psychological warfare and about the Black Panthers presenting some kind of victory, psychological equality. But makes no mention of the warfare what is being conducted on them is warfare. But I felt that when he talks about how one informer in the Black Panthers group was made to inform on another informer within the Black Panther group. I thought that was, I appreciated that, him sharing that information about white supremacy war tactics, because then you embed the first informer even more into the group because now they're trusted more. So I think that's something that people should remember. I feel debased and humiliated by its all too human nature. I couldn't relate to that. Why would one feel debased by being a human? So there's a lot of inadequacy, projection. But so far, I thought there was just one or two things that were quite useful for me in learning about how white males think about black people. And this is supposed to be a liberal white man. I mute my line. Thank you.
Silent Warrior, our caller, in Norway, much obliged to hear from you, sir. Glad he is still with us a week after our hiatus, still hanging with us. We get our obligatory time stamp, 4:46 a.m. Norway time, almost 5 a.m. I guess it's Friday morning, geez.
Much obliged for the commentary, sir. Any other folks with comments they wanted to get on the second audio segment?
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, great, cool. I made a couple of notes. I don't think I did very well because they're not very legible, but I'll do my best. You kept on talking about a black problem, in quotes, and I find it very interesting because I think I'm thinking he's talking about racism, white supremacy, and racism, white supremacy is always talked about as a problem for people who are not white, black people. And it just points to the fact that racism, white supremacy is not a problem for white people because they don't call it a white problem. It's not a problem for white people. It's just a way of life. What do I want to say? That black guy, he referred to him as black, just a black, and he also referred to him as a black cat. and what else? Oh, that dog, when he was petting the dog, the white dog, and to me, he was describing the dog very sexually. I think he called the dog voluptuous. He called the dog full bosomed. And at one point, he said something is mild, being wet with emotion or something like that. I found the description very sexual. Yeah, which was disturbing. what else? Yeah, he said something about Calista. So I think he's like an awful writer. Right, he said something about Calista, and he's like, you know, he wrote that in the book, and he's like, oh, in case you didn't know, I put that in there. I'm like, why is that in the book? Why did you still need to write it? And at some points in the book, he comes across like he just likes to, I guess, see words on paper, or likes to just hear himself talk. My last point is when he started talking about the Black Panthers, and I think he said, let me see if I found it here. Yes, let me go back. My purpose is to convey at least a small impression of the poison, sick, treacherous atmosphere of suspicion, provocation, uncertainty, and continuous state of siege in which Black Panthers live and work. Yes, work. And it is probably the most successful group therapy undertaken in the long struggle against deliberate psychological crippling, maiming, and snickering friendly persuasion. And all those words right there, I'm like, what are you, is he talking about the racism and white supremacy? And why are all those words there? You know, if it seemed like, you know, like in the whole, even in this whole book, I haven't really seen the word white supremacy, really. And I think I did see him use the word white once so far to describe himself and not say a white man. But he used that word white and follow up to say, the kind of white who has had enough of the black problem. And also, when he starts talking about the black problem and he goes into this segue when he starts talking about alienation, I wonder if he's saying that the quote-unquote black problem is the reason why he feels alienated. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Much obliged for your commentary, ma'am. Excellent. That alienation, Dr. Welsing, she has a whole section in the book talking about the root of white alienation, anxiety, separation, all of that related to white genetic annihilation and why they practice white supremacy worldwide. Other folks, if you have any thoughts to get in, we have like 9 minutes left before we wrap up, so almost done. A great commentary from the folks who participated about the homoerotic components of the book and the way that the black characters are described, even the kind of sexualized way that the dog is described in the text, the City of Light, great observations, and just paying attention to the metaphors that are being used in the book. Let's see, notes from the second portion. I'll just say a few things, and I'll double-check, make sure we didn't miss anyone. From the second portion of the text, where it's Keyes is deliberately training this child. I said it's going to be more of that, training his son to respond to hate. I thought that was great commentary from a listener who wrote in that this sort of codification would terrify racists. But also I just thought it was another degrading illustration of how black people are depicted. It's not that we care about black children. Just, oh, he's so filled with hate. That's why he's so good with the snakes. He's so filled with hate. He just wants to expose his child to all that hate. Have it. You could just turn on. I thought they just said they killed Dr. King. He could just sit him in front of the television and mission accomplished. Let's see. Oh, he said, wait a minute. He says, both concluded Keyes was thinking of his son and not the dog, and that he had put his kid inside the cage to expose him to the sight of hate and to train him to feel used to it and impervious to it. It would only be too easy to accuse me of being a writer given to flights of dark imagination. Let's see. They used the word reconciliation this week with the dog and Keyes. Let's see. So we had black fiendishness before and talking about maybe black people killed Dr. King. And then on 142, he says, talking about that you have to act real fast and get a hold of them in the right place, and I'm sure if I'd shown a trace of hesitation, that fiend would have just thrown the snake into my arms. I was too busy watching the Twister to think of stopping this devil I'm paying $200 a week, talking about Keyes as a fiend and a devil, as he gives him a serpent to go and get the dog. Like, again, the description, how black people are talked about in this book, and compare that to even the dog, like I said, or how he talks about other white people. Let's see. I thought the section where Keyes says that he's a white dog's house nigger, brilliant, brilliant from Keyes. Let's see. Here we go again, the nigger rapist. Now, the Che Guevara syndrome is inverting the process, the truly lunatic fringe of the extremist, black identity extremists, even in the 60s, is trying to cash in politically on every black rapist, thief, or murder and make revolutionary capital of their action. What Negro rapist became a revolutionary figure of the 1960s? I think Eldridge Cleaver is maybe the only one I can think of, and he went to prison, talked about raping, or he did rape black females and said that that was his practice for raping white women, but I don't remember him becoming like a cause celeb, like, yeah, Eldridge Cleaver, raping black females, he is, you know, champion, and I don't remember that. I don't remember, you know, lots of black rapists like Huey P. Newton, Angela Davis, who was there a Willie Horton from the 90s that I missed that became like a poster child for the movement? Like, you have to give me some names, buddy. Like, that just criminalizing of black people is standard operation, and particularly if you're going to start out with every rapist, give me a name. And I would be especially curious because he just spoke glowingly after he spent all that time talking about how Stokely Carmichael is a no-count, no-good this, and blah, 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 and gaming niggers and gaming whiteys. At least you can respect Eldridge Cleaver. What? A convicted rapist? You can respect his view, but Stokely Carmichael, no-count, nigger. All right. Let's see. Have some other notes. I'll pause it. Other folks, anything else they want to get in before we conclude the last few minutes?
May I speak?
Yes, sir.
Thank you. I just saw on Atlantic Backstar that a black man, it's been reported that a black man was attacked by a canine dog, even when he was not resisting. And the white officer, after the dog was after he had him in handcuffs, said Bro, you're listening great now. You weren't listening great a minute ago. Bro. So this text is quite relevant because, you know, who knows, probably this text, White Dog, is will give you some insight into how these police officers that work with dogs also think, because they're in close proximity with these animals. And one other thing in the text was that there's a point where he speaks about the dog Bacta in one of his fits of white rage was a frightening sight. And this is the first time the dog barking and is referred to as white rage. So I think that's interesting. In general, I think, you know, the white dog seems to symbolize the side, you know, Neely Fuller Jr. says that racism is conducted with either deceit, deception, or violence. And although the author is saying that the dog represents him, yes, I see that too, but in the text, the author is doing a lot of deception. And the dog, he's just straight up violent. So I think that's something that keeps coming to mind as well. On one hand, you have deception. On the other hand, you have violence or indirect violence. So, yeah. Something I tend to look for in suspect races. Thank you for selecting this text. This is reading through the book. It makes helps me to filter and think about experiences with white people that have been where I felt threatened or so on, and to sense to try. Someone mentioned to me a month ago when I was telling them about Dr. Watson's theory that in his observation, white people seem to enjoy letting you know that they're on top or that they have power over you. And the author, when he conducts his deception, I believe he is doing the same. Thank you. I'll mute my line.
I'll be heard.
Thomas in New York. Kind of short time, so just
very
be mindful.
Very yes, short. Just a tidbit. You mentioned the great Mark Essex. I just want to say the first, all cops are white to be, but the first white cop that just the Essex shot was trying to sick a dog on. He turned around to open up the car door, and he shot him right in the back before he got a chance to. I think that he understood the danger he was in if that dog got free.
Mr. Essex, member of the Black Panther Party, Black Rage in New Orleans, we talked about him a few times, actually, on the program. We did our 3 hours. We will be back next week. Like I said, we have a page or two over the halfway point in the book, so we'll be back. Lots more to discuss before we get to the end, so more to review. If you are listening to the archives, you can email in untiljustice@gmail.com. We'll catch up. Never a good thing, black people being terrorized and bitten, but as I said, relevant, super relevant in many ways, toilet paper and all, to what is going on right now. We'll be back, normal schedule, workplace racism, tomorrow, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Much obliged to everyone tuning in. Hope it was worthy of your Thursday evening hyphen Friday morning, very early Friday morning. Again, reading more important than watching television. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white terrorism. We need our brain computer. You got white dogs. You got the Rona. Racist man, racist woman. I mean, a lot of hazards. We have to make great decisions, sometimes life-saving decisions, on a pretty regular basis. So probably want to have that brain computer working at maximum efficiency. In addition to being sober, let's be buckled. I'm still of the opinion we should be kind of hunkering down anywhere in the known universe, particularly in the U.S. Lots of armed white people have been out all year long brandishing and threatening black people. And racist dogs have been out, apparently. Many reasons to kind of hunker down. If you are going to go out, I would be super alert about your surroundings. If it looks like any white person is getting aggressive, loud, maybe hostile, this whole outing is done. Preserve your safety. That's code I've applied myself. Might even have to call enforcement officers, but do so as you are exiting. Take it very serious. Lots of armed folks out there causing much, much chaos. So we're sober. If you go out, you're buckled and alert. If you are driving, you are not on the cell phone. We need maximum attention. Be paying attention to what's happening, and we're trying to do as much as we can to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no. That said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, brother.
No problem. A victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.